From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, when climbing is literally in your blood, we meet Sherpa Jamling Tenzing Norgay. His father summited Mount Everest with Sir Edmund Hillary, the first successful expedition to the top. Norgay was climbing leader for the 1996 Everest IMAX filming expedition, the year eight people died in a sudden storm. Also, we hear from Kenneth Kamler, who was team doctor on three expeditions to the top of Everest, including the 1996 climb. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Death in Holy Orders, the new mystery by P.D. James. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. and Chinese officials met for a second time today in Beijing to discuss the April 1st collision between U.S. and Chinese military aircraft. U.S. officials described the session as businesslike. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
After the first meeting yesterday, U.S. officials said there would not be a second unless China agreed to discuss the return of the U.S. reconnaissance plane. U.S. Ambassador Joseph Preer delivered that message to China's foreign ministry. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says the Chinese assured Preer all issues the U.S. wanted to discuss would be on the table. Boucher says a second meeting then was held and all of the issues were addressed. Boucher says the U.S. has given China a proposal for repairing and returning the U.S. aircraft, and the Chinese have said they'll respond to it through normal diplomatic channels. According to Boucher, the U.S. also has proposed creating a working group under an existing military-maritime accord to address how to avoid such incidents in the future. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush said today that he doesn't plan to ease sanctions on Iran and Libya, even though the United States is looking for ways to increase world oil production. The president told reporters that although he'd like to relieve some of the pressures that keep oil prices high, he has no intention of easing sanctions against the two oil producers. Research in a government-sponsored study released today provides some new insights on the effects of child care. Minnesota Public Radio's Tom Scheck reports.
The findings were presented today at an academic meeting in Minneapolis. It says young children who spend more than 30 hours a week in child care showed more signs of problem behaviors by the age of 4.5 than children who spent less than 10 hours in similar settings. The study tracked more than 1,300 infants and toddlers since 1991. The study's lead author, Jay Belsky of Birkbeck College in London, says an estimated 17% were rated by caregivers, mothers, and teachers as disobedient or defiant. Some 6% of those who spent less time in daycare were rated the same way. Belsky and his team hasn't determined what causes the increase or if child care is to blame. He did note that higher quality child care tended to reduce the association between long hours of care and later aggressive behavior. For NPR News, I'm Tom Scheck in St. Paul, Minnesota.
The space shuttle Endeavour is on its way to a rendezvous with the International Space Station. The shuttle is on a mission to install a billion-dollar robot arm on the space station. NASA says the installation will be the most complicated robotics mission ever attempted in space. Endeavour is scheduled to dock with the space station on Saturday. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 77 points to close at 10,693 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ gained 102 points, or nearly 5%, to close at 2185. This is NPR News. People in the upper Midwest are watching the level of the Mississippi River, which is still rising against the dikes built in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. The river could crest as early as tomorrow. Some homes in the area are already partly flooded. A federal court has reinstated the superintendent of the Kansas City, Missouri School District after the city's school board fired him in an emergency meeting. Matt Hackworth reports from member station KCUR.
U.S. District Judge Dean Whipple ordered Superintendent Benjamin Demps and his staff back to work just hours after the school board named two interim co-superintendents. The court order also summons both sides to a court hearing where the board must show cause for their actions. Demps is the 19th Kansas City superintendent in 30 years.
I am pleased that the court has seen fit to issue this stay. It allows me and the staff the opportunity to get back to the work and continue to focus on the education of our children.
The predominantly black Kansas City School District is Missouri's only school system that failed to achieve state accreditation. Fixing the district has created a power struggle between Demps and a group of board members, which has some state lawmakers proposing a state takeover of the district. For NPR News, I'm Matt Hackworth in Kansas City.
Survivors and relatives of victims of the Oklahoma City bombing will be able to watch the execution of Timothy McVeigh by closed-circuit TV at a federal prison in Oklahoma City. Officials had been looking for a secure place to show the execution where there'd be less chance the video could be pirated by hackers. Today is the 6th anniversary of the bombing. Survivors and relatives observed 168 seconds of silence. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting the Steven Spielberg film Schindler's List, tonight at 8 Eastern on PBS stations. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Jomling Tenzing Norgay says he climbs mountains because it's in his blood. Born in Darjeeling, India, Norgay belongs to the Sherpa ethnic group, a mountain people who have traditionally served as guides for foreign climbers in the Himalayas. His father, Tenzing Norgay Sherpa, was the first person, along with Sir Edmund Hillary, to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 1953. Norgay hiked and trekked in the region with his father as a child and says that ever since he was 6 years old, he dreamed of one day also making it to the top of Everest. But his father, who died when Norgay was 21, discouraged him, maintaining that he climbed his whole life so that his children wouldn't have to. But Norgay persisted. Finally, his opportunity came in 1996 when he was invited to join the IMAX filming expedition on Everest. While the film team was on the mountain, a sudden storm blew in, resulting in the death of 8 climbers from another expedition. In his new book, Touching My Father's Soul, Norgay writes of his experience on Everest and the spiritual significance climbing the world's highest mountain holds for him and once held for his father.
You know, there's something about it that called him to the mountain all the time. And ever since he was a small boy, he had dreams of climbing this mountain and always, you know, he was always attracted to it. And in the lectures that I followed with him, and I heard from him. He talked a lot about, you know, the experience of climbing, but when I personally sat down to talk to him, he would not talk to me too much about the climbing techniques, but more about what the mountain was, what the mountain meant to him, and those were all in the religious sense, because Mount Everest, we call Chomo Longma, and the deity that resides on Everest, Mio Langsangma. You know, she's the deity that my father worshipped. And he always, you know, told me, you know, that you should always respect the mountains because they are the abode of the snows where the gods live. And he, I think, had a different view, you know, like just like I do. And I learned from him and from other Sherpas about viewing mountains differently than just another rock.
Now, your father was celebrated around the world after he made it to the summit with Sir Edmund Hillary in 1953. He was awarded the George Medal from the Queen of England. You were born 13 years later. How did your father's fame affect your family life? How did you feel it as a kid?
Life for us was normal while we went to school in Darjeeling. Because my father lived there, you know, he was just a normal person there. Being his son, you know, being the son of a famous father, he was away a lot. We were in boarding school, you know, for 12 years we were in boarding school.
You and your brothers?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, me and my 2 brothers, Norbu and Dame, and my sister, Dicky. You know, all of us were in boarding school. So, you know, I personally didn't have much time to spend with him and, you know, to be with him.
So you missed him as a kid?
Yes. I think I missed him as a kid and as a young adult. And just when I was in my teens is when I came to the U.S. to go to school, and then he passed away before, you know, it was too late to learn anything. And I think my whole motivation to pursue climbing this mountain was to try to learn, you know, what I had missed, you know, while my father was alive.
At the time that you were invited to be part of the IMAX filming expedition, what was your climbing experience? What mountains had you climbed?
I was in the U.S. for almost 9 or 10 years, and before that, I had done some climbing in the Sikkim Himalayas, and these are all small mountains. We call them, you know, trekking peaks, and they can range up to 21 to 22,000 feet from 18,000. And in 92, I did a small expedition, a solo expedition, to do some 5 summits in Sikkim. And as far as high altitude, you know, I had not been up above 21,500 or so. And this was my first high altitude, you know, high, big mountain.
Were you afraid that maybe you didn't have the strength or the skill to make it to the top, given that all the other members of the expedition had significant experience in high altitudes?
No, you know, this is something that I felt ever since I was a boy, that I was going to climb Mount Everest sooner or later. And I was confident, even when I was at the age of 18, when I asked my father I wanted to climb this mountain, I was very confident of, you know, getting to the top. And not because of my strength, but it's just I had faith in myself and in the mountain that, you know, I was going to climb this mountain one day. And as far as being fit for this mountain, you know, I was a Sherpa, you know, by ethnic group, my, you know, being a Sherpa and being the son of Tenzing Norgay also, I think, gave me a boost that, you know, I have it in my blood to climb this mountain and to do what my father had done before.
Do you mean that literally, physiologically?
Yes. I think we, the Sherpas, are believed, you know, to have, you know, bigger lungs. And, you know, we adapt to higher altitudes a lot faster and, you know, easily than any other humans in the planet here.
You were offered the position of climbing leader on the expedition. What were you responsible for?
Well, my responsibilities, you know, climbing Everest in 96 and when my father climbed Everest in 1953 were, we had very, it was very similar, you know, in regard to my father and my role. And my role was to help, you know, get all the loads up to the higher camps, make sure that all the camps are well stocked and the campsites are put up, the fixed ropes are up. You know, I organized groups of Sherpas who would fix the ropes on the mountain.
These are the ropes that the climbers
use,
follow
yes.
and use
yes.
And
yes.
attach their gear to.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I was more of a liaison between the Sherpas and the members, because I, you know, I could speak English and I can speak Nepali and Sherpa, and because sometimes you can get into some misunderstanding between the members and the Sherpas.
After you hired porters to carry loads to base camp and you established a camp there, you described the whole scene at the base camp of Everest as a boom town without a mayor, and you said that you write that it reminded you of college. What is it like there at base camp in Everest?
It's a zoo. You know, you have, when we were climbing, there were about 15 expeditions. And each expedition has an average of 10 members and another about 20 Sherpas. So it's about 35, maybe up to 45 to 50, you know, people in one expedition. And that's a lot when you have, you know, 15, 16 expeditions. Every camp, you know, is unique because everybody has their own dining tent. They have a storage tent, you know. It's almost as big as your grocery stores over here. They have all the goodies in there, and they have communication tents now. And things that people bring in today is a little bit too much, you know, too much of high-tech. And with so many people there, you know, there's not much, too much space in the base camp area. I mean, it's big, but there's only a few nice areas to camp because it's all on a glacier. Because and the ice is always melting below you.
My guest is Jamling Tenzing Norgay. His father, Tenzing Norgay Sherpa, was the first man, along with Sir Edmund Hillary, to reach the summit of Mount Everest in 1953. Jamling Norgay also made it to the top of Everest with the IMAX filming expedition in 1996. He has a new book about the trip called Touching My Father's Soul. We'll talk more in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jamling Tenzing Norgay. His father, Tenzing Norgay Sherpa, accompanied Sir Edmund Hillary on the first ascent of Everest in 1953. Just 5 years ago, Jamling Norgay also made it to the top of that mountain as a member of the IMAX filming expedition. Now, the first really dangerous part of the climb is called the Khumbu Icefall. What Yes. makes it so dangerous? And you point out that it's particularly dangerous for Sherpas carrying loads.
Yes, yes. Now, the Khumbu Icefall is a very, it's almost like a large river of ice boulders moving, you know, a couple of feet a day. And you never know when these boulders are going to collapse, or it's sort of a labyrinth of, you know, these ice blocks. And you don't know when one of the crevices is going to open or close, or, you might be on a ladder crossing one of the crevices, and all of a sudden if it closes or opens, then you're in trouble. Or, you know, a boulder falls on you, and it's very unpredictable in this area, especially in the later part of the day, because as the sun comes out, you know, ice melts and it gets warmer and there's more movement. And Sherpas are more, you know, they risk their lives a lot more than anyone else because they ferry loads up to the higher camps, you know, a lot more. I mean, in one climb or one climb on Everest, I think, or on average, a Sherpa goes through the ice fall maybe about 18, 20 times, maybe more. And whereas a Westerner would probably go up the ice fall maybe like 4 times or 5 times at the most. And so that way, you know, the Sherpas are, they risk their lives, you know, a lot more.
How many times did you pass through it on the 1996 expedition?
I went through the ice fall maybe about 9 or 10 times. And I did not go through it as much as, you know, the other Sherpas did. And I went through it with the team members because we were doing the film. We were filming and I had to be with them all the time. And it was not something that I look forward to going through because every time it, you know, the ice fall would change if we went through it you know, today and 3 days later when we go through it again, you know, it looked a little different. And so, you know, the ladder's been moved. And we had a team of Sherpas that maintained the icefall for 2 months. The sole job was to go up and down the icefall every morning. That was like 3-4 in the morning, then go up to make sure that the route was still safe. If it wasn't, their job was to fix the icefall and then come back.
While your team was waiting to summit, at the same time, a sudden storm came up and endangered the lives of another expedition. 8 climbers lost their lives in that storm. The story is told in John Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, and a number of other books about the trip. At what point did you know that the climbers making the ascent on May 10th, 1996, were in trouble?
You know, I think we sensed trouble that afternoon, when we looking through the telescope, you know, up on the ridge between the Hillary Step and the South Summit, we can see climbers. They were still up there at about 3 o'clock. You know, they were going for the summit, and immediately David looked at me. You know, David Brashears and Robert Schauer, and Ed Wiesters. You know, we looked at each other and said, you know, the communication between our eyes was like, there is going to be trouble because it is very late, you know, to be up that high on the mountain at that time.
Where were you on the mountain?
We were lower down in Camp 2. which is at about 21,000 feet, 21,500 feet. And we can see straight up on, you know, on Mount Everest. And we noticed that, you know, when people were still climbing at that time, we wondered why, what was going on. And we even sort of partly felt that there might be trouble. Even the day before, when we saw all these 30-some-odd people going up towards the last camp. And there were quite a few of them that were inexperienced, and they were very slow.
The team leader of that expedition, Rob Hall, was stranded and was in radio communication with other climbers and also with his wife. Did you hear any of those radio transmissions?
Oh, yes, I did. I was in the tent when they were talking, and it was a very, very sad moment. I mean, at one point I broke down, you know, and I just left the tent because, you know, I could not take any more. And it reminded me also a lot about, you know, why I was on the mountain and about, you know, hoping that I would not have to make the same call to my wife, you know, back home.
Was he pretending things were all right, or how did the conversation go?
I think that when he talked to his wife, I think he knew that, you know, he was not going to make it. You know, he basically was giving up. And he knew that this was probably going to be the last time he was ever going to talk to his wife. And, you know, but he was very strong and very, you know, good about it. You know, he, you know, tried to keep a straight face and trying to convince his wife that he was going to come down and, you know, not to worry, that he was going to be fine and there was going to be help. And which at that point we knew, you know, that it was not going to happen. And that's what really hit us, was when they were talking about this.
I think a lot of people thought in the wake of this that too many inexperienced climbers can pay a high price and attempt a summit, and in the process endanger the lives of guides and also of Sherpas.
Others, yes, yes.
What's your perspective on that?
I feel that if a person wants to endanger their lives, you know, that is not right. I mean, at least if you want to climb Everest, you should come there with some experience or have climbed some other mountains. The commercial teams should screen the climbers before taking them on, you know, a big mountain and a dangerous mountain like Mount Everest.
What was the thinking among the other Sherpas on your team during the rescue effort? Did they feel they weren't going to take risks to go out and find stranded climbers without extra pay or incentive?
Well, a few of the Sherpas that were up there, you know, they volunteered freely to go up and help. And they are, again, employees, you know, of the Western groups there. So they have to follow the leader. If the leader says, well, you go and rescue, you know, because a lot of times we don't want to give away, you know, the Sherpa people, you know, the Sherpas that are on the mountain, because they're trying to save them and save their energy, you know, to do some other thing or to help, you know, bring some other people down, or maybe to go up and to go up higher on the mountain to bring those people down. And, you know, and a lot of times in moments like these, leaders come out and say, well, we'll give you an extra bonus when you go up and, you know, help, or when you do another trip to bring back this injured climber down the mountain, which happened in the beginning of the climb, where we had to bring, you know, where we had to collect about 35 Sherpas to bring this one injured climber down the mountain.
I've read that dead bodies litter Everest, that the bodies of climbers have been left there in many cases. Did you see any?
Yes, I did. Actually, I saw maybe about five or six bodies up there. And it's not a pretty sight, you know, to see the first body that I ever saw on the mountain just scared me. Because I've heard so much about them, but never seen them personally. And right, you know, we had to walk right past by one of them. It's almost not even a full body, but sort of a half body wrapped up in some tarpaulin. And it gives you a chill and sort of makes you wonder why you are here. And, you know, you can end up like one of them. And we climbed, you know, like I said, after when the accidents took place, when these people died, when we climbed afterwards, that's when we passed through a lot of the bodies that were, you know, of friends that had just died, you know, a couple of days ago. And it was a very sad sight, you know, to see friends lying there frozen and knowing that there was nothing we could do to help them.
I think Sherpas have a name for bodies down on the mountain.
Yeah, the ones below, we call them momos. You know, it's sort of a joke. We have it's sort of a Tibetan Sherpa delicacy, so like meat dumplings. And I was surprised when the Sherpas told me, oh, this is a momo. You know, I was like, well, it's not really that funny. But then later on, after I was on the mountain for a while, you tend to sort of get the joke and so you keep some humor to, you know, keep you moving.
I think your father attempted Everest 7 times. Is it something
Yes.
you wanted to do again?
No, my father tried, you know, 6 times, and then on the 7th attempt, he finally made it because this is something he wanted to do all his life. And after the 7th time, when he finally made it, he did not have, you know, he did not even attempt to climb Everest. And I was very lucky to have made it on my first attempt, and I don't have any plans to go back again because, you know, I have completed my goal. You know, I have fulfilled my dream of following my father's footsteps and being there with him, and I don't see any reason to go back again because it's done. And, you know, I'm happy with what I have. And, you know, what I've learned from, you know, this mountain.
Jomling Tenzing Norgay, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you very much, Barbara.
Jomling Tenzing Norgay's new book is Touching My Father's Soul. Norgay is one of 3 climbers featured in the IMAX film Everest. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Mogah, a novel about the tulipomania set in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, treating extreme frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness. We feature an interview with Dr. Kenneth Kamler, who's made several climbs on Mount Everest as an expedition doctor. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Death in Holy Orders, the new mystery by P.D. James.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. During the disastrous snowstorm on Mount Everest in 1996, Dr. Kenneth Kamler was on the mountain taking care of survivors. That was one of several climbs he's made as an expedition doctor on Everest. He's treated extreme frostbite, snow blindness, and altitude sickness, and has risked his life to save others. He's conducted research on Everest in conjunction with National Geographic and NASA. Dr. Kamler is also a hand surgeon. He directs the Hand Treatment Center in New Hyde Park, New York. He's the author of a memoir called Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. Terry spoke with Kenneth Kamler last December. She asked him how good a climber you have to be in order to work as an expedition doctor.
Well, of course, that depends on what mountain you're climbing.
Good point.
Yeah, on a mountain like Everest, you have to be, a very accomplished climber to even get started on the mountain. It's a very technically difficult mountain, and many of the difficulties come right at the beginning. So if you want to be an effective doctor, you have to be up where the problems are, which are high up for the most part, and you can't even get there if you're not able to get past the first barriers, which come lower down.
And the problems are high up because that's where the oxygen thins and where the air pressure changes.
Yeah, if you think about it, the summit of Everest is 29,035 feet. That's about the same height as the cruising altitude for a transatlantic jet. So there's only about a third as much oxygen as there is at sea level, and your body can't burn fuel efficiently at that height. So your metabolism is sort of like smoldering instead of burning, and you can't give yourself enough energy, so it's easy to get into trouble at that altitude.
What are some of the medicines you pack with you when you're working as an expedition doctor?
That's a difficult problem. It's like Everest itself. The challenge of packing medicine is daunting if you don't take it one step at a time. So I try and think of every injury I might encounter and every problem I might run into. Then I list every supply I would need for it, from cardiac stimulants to adhesive tape, because if I don't bring it, I don't have it, and I have no chance of getting it. But even more subtly, I have to consider the quantities which I have to bring, because in climbing, weight is critical, and I have to limit my supplies, recognizing that I might run short in a major disaster. And as you go up the mountain, you can take less and less. I started base camp with about 4 yak loads of supplies, but by camp 2, which is 4,000 feet higher, I'm reduced to just a fishing tackle box worth of equipment. And then higher than that, I just take what I can put in a plastic bag and keep inside my pocket. Medications freeze. If I don't carry them right against my chest, they'll be frozen and, for the most part, unusable.
What are some of the main differences in how the body works high on a mountain compared to how the body works at ground level?
Yeah, the biggest problem is with the lack of air. There's only one-third the air pressure as there is at sea level. And since metabolism depends on burning oxygen, you don't have that ability. And it's, as I was saying before, it's like a smoldering fire. So your metabolism is very low. Plus, at that altitude, temperatures can run 40 degrees below zero or even colder. And you can have winds that can be up to 40 miles an hour or more. You're so high up that you're actually exposed to the jet stream. So you're dealing with wind chill factors that you'd only find on the surface of Mars, maybe. And added to that, you're at the summit after several days of relentless climbing. You've probably had very little to eat or drink. You've had maybe half a bowl of warm water on summit day when you start out. And you'll be out for 16 or 20 hours that day. It's a very, very long day. And you'll be burning 12 to 15,000 calories, which is about 10 times your normal amount. So you're really on the edge of survival there. And to give you an idea of just how thin the margin of survival is, I remember on one of my own summit attempts, I was carrying a water bottle inside my down jacket against my chest. And as I was coming back from the attempt, I wanted to take a drink of water, and I reached inside my jacket, and my water bottle was frozen. So you really see how thin your margin of survival is there.
Gee, remind me to climb a mountain on my next vacation.
I wonder myself what I'm doing there sometimes.
What's breathing like that high up?
Well, as you get higher, it gets harder to breathe. At that height, it's essentially taking one step and then several breaths and then one more step and then several breaths. It becomes extremely laborious to breathe. Breathing requires muscle power, and you get to the point where the muscle power required to breathe uses up more oxygen than what you're taking in. So it becomes a law of diminishing returns. In fact, the summit of Everest is physiologically just about man's limit as to where they can breathe.
What's the impact on your ability to think clearly and to remember things when you have so little oxygen getting to your brain because the air is so thin? Does it make it difficult for you to function well as a doctor?
Yes, it does. I'm called upon to make some critical medical decisions, which are complicated enough in a modern hospital intensive care unit. And I'm often in a situation where I'm not getting enough oxygen myself, and it's very cold, and the cold is sort of debilitating as well. So you often have a situation where it's hard to think clearly, and sometimes it's literally confusing to figure out how to tie your shoes. That becomes a problem, much less making difficult medical decisions. But I find that I'm aware that I'm thinking slowly. It's not like I'm hallucinating. I'm very aware of the situation. I'm aware I'm thinking slowly, and therefore I can just sort of concentrate and focus, and I find I can get the job done, even though it's a little harder than would be at sea level.
So what happens if you need a doctor?
Yeah, that's what people often say to me up on the mountain. The people I climb with are very experienced, and they very often do climb without doctors on other expeditions. So many of them do have a good deal of medical experience. Some of them are emergency medical technicians, and they've had a lot of firsthand experience. So I think that they would be able to take care of me in an emergency situation.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler talking with Terry Gross. His memoir is Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine at the Top of the World. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's interview with Everest expedition doctor Kenneth Kamler.
You were an expedition doctor in 1996 during the storm on Everest, in which so much has been written and filmed about. Where were you during the storm?
Yeah, when that storm hit, I was at 24,000 feet, which is what we call Camp 3. And the climbers who got in trouble were 2,000 feet above me at Camp 4. They had just gone for the summit that day. And we were in our camp below them, listening on the radio as to what had happened to them. And we had heard that they had summited in the afternoon. But even though there was some celebration on their part, it made us all very nervous because they had summited very late in the afternoon. It's a good rule to make sure you have enough daylight to get back, with plenty to spare. And they had summited about 2:30 in the afternoon, which was a very late time to be coming down. They only had a few hours of daylight left and no margin for error. And at that point, we was just sort of hoping they'd get back down, but a storm came up, and unexpectedly, the mountain was just engulfed by the worst, most intense storm I've ever seen, and we knew that they were still out high above their camp, which would have been their shelter, so we were quite nervous about them, and it got dark, and we still had no word that they were back, and in fact, they did not get back. They were stuck out in that storm, and they were unable to get back to their tents. So I was at Camp 3 at that point, which was a place where I would be unable to even treat anybody. We were 2,000 feet below them. They were almost inaccessible to us, but our strongest climbers risked their lives to go up and try and rescue them. And two of our climbers did make it up to the area where most of the climbers were and started doing what they could for first aid. Where I was, I could radio advice, but we realized we'd have to get the survivors back down if I was going to treat them at all. There was no way that I could get up to that height, and there would be nothing I could do for them at that height anyway. So,
what did you do to prepare in the hopes that climbers would come down, knowing that if they did come down, they would need help?
Well, I was in a place where I was on a 45-degree icy slope. It's just a notch cut into the mountain. The camp is really it's just enough room for a tent, and you can't even stand up without roping yourself in. It's bitter cold. Everything freezes. I had very little equipment with me. I just had that plastic bag worth of supplies. My supplies were 2,000 feet lower down. So we felt that if we could get the survivors down to the next lower camp, Camp 2, we'd have a much better chance of treating them and keeping them alive. So we worked out a plan where the climbers would have to stay overnight at Camp 4, which was already a dangerous place to stay, but there was just no way we could bring them down that late in the day. So we waited overnight. The climbers did survive overnight, and as they were being brought down by the rescuers, I myself down-climbed 2,000 feet to that lower camp So what I did was I took the New Zealand camp's mess tent, which was the largest tent in the area, and turned that essentially into a little field hospital. I laid out foam mats on the ice and sleeping bags on top of those. We collected sets of dry clothes because I anticipated that the climbers would be soaked and they would have to get out of their freezing clothes. I hooked up IV bags from the tent, which had to be defrosted first in warm water. And we had oxygen tanks. I opened them up, got them ready, put out my bandages, my medications. And I had the Sherpas boil up as much water as we could because I anticipated some severe frostbite. I knew I'd have to warm their body parts.
How many people made it down who you ended up treating?
There were two critical climbers who came down. Beck Weathers, the American climber who got a lot of publicity in the United States, and a Taiwanese climber named Makalu Gao, who was in very similar condition as Beck. They both had severe frostbite and hypothermia.
Well, how did you treat Beck Weathers? Many Americans saw the photos of his extreme frostbite when he came down from the mountaintop. He wasn't expected to live. Go ahead.
Yeah, he was not expected to live. In fact, when we first heard about Beck, we heard that he was dead. That was our first report. He had been found in the snow at Camp 4 and pronounced dead. And our rescuers were tending to the other ones who were still alive when Beck suddenly just appeared out of the whiteout, out of a swirling fog, and he just staggered into base camp. And I remember getting the radio report from one of the rescuers. He said, "Beck is alive, but I don't know for how long." We really weren't sure he'd even survive the night, but he did survive the night, and he was brought back down to us. When I caught up with him at Camp 2, I expected an incoherent, half-conscious phantom, but he walked into the tent, and he said, "Hi, Ken, where should I sit?" He was really very well-oriented, much better than I expected. So we laid him down on the mat and on the sleeping bag, and we started an IV, and I started to examine him, and he had the worst frostbite I've ever seen, and I've seen quite a bit of frostbite. His right hand and wrist were purple and frozen, and all the way to a third of the way up his forearm. His left hand was also frozen. His nose was just a brittle black crust. It looked as if he would sneeze, he would just blow it away. So the first thing to do was to make sure that he wouldn't die of hypothermia. So we started that intravenous line, but that in itself is a problem because the fluids are so cold at that altitude. They have to first be defrosted, and then you have to make sure they're warm because the last thing you want to do is put cold fluid into someone who's already cold. So we used hand warmers, the kind of chemical hand warmers that skiers might use, and wrapped them around the IV bags to try to keep them warm. Once I was sure Beck was warm enough, we started the process of trying to thaw out his hands and feet. So we had buckets of warm water, and I put his hands and feet in there. It was very difficult to keep the water warm because of the outside temperature being below zero and because of the fact that his hands and feet were essentially blocks of ice, and they would cool the water very rapidly. So we had to keep reheating the water and adding it and measuring the temperature. It was a difficult, very time-consuming job, but the Sherpas, most of whom had never used a thermometer before in their lives, very quickly got the hang of how to do it and sort of took over monitoring the temperature while I could look into their medical condition a little more.
Are there any dangers when you're defrosting somebody's body parts that have frostbite? Are there any dangers in having the temperature being too warm or in trying to defrost them too rapidly?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that people don't realize very often. I'm dealing with a frozen body part, and when I try to rewarm that, if I do it too quickly, of course, they might get burns. And since their hands are not able to feel pain, they wouldn't even be able to tell me. So you have to be very careful about the temperature. And, of course, if it's too low, you're not going to be effective. But an even more difficult problem is that if their bodies are not warm, their hearts will be a little bit cool. And cooled heart muscle is very sensitive, and it can react by going into what we call an arrhythmia, a pattern of beating which would not allow blood to flow and can be fatal. So I had to be careful that their body temperature was high enough where their heart was functioning properly, because if I suddenly rewarm their hands, that wave of cold, of cold blood, which would come out of their hands into their body, could be a shock which could kill them.
So how did he survive your treatment?
Well, he did amazingly well. He did survive, as did Makalu. They lived through the night. I stayed up all night taking care of them, just making sure their IVs were working, making sure they were breathing. In the morning, we were hoping that a helicopter would be able to come to evacuate the two climbers, but the wind was still blowing so hard that there was just no way the helicopter pilot said he could land. So at that point, I had to make a decision as to whether or not I should try to keep them at 21,000 feet in a second day, or whether we should try to evacuate them over the ice. Over the ice evacuation is quite dangerous. You have to go through a lot of crevasses. It's technically difficult, and it would not be me who would be risking his life to evacuate these people, since we would be using our strongest climbers. So I would be asking our strongest climbers to risk their lives to bring down these two sick climbers. But the alternative was to leave them another day at 21,000 feet, and I didn't feel they could survive another day at that altitude. That 21,000 feet is an altitude where cuts won't even heal. And I had two climbers who were so critically ill that I've seen healthier-looking patients die in an intensive care unit.
Why won't cuts heal at that altitude?
There's just not enough oxygen. The body is functioning at its bare limit. The body does what it has to do to keep itself alive, but it has no extra energy, so to speak, to bring about healing. It's the last place you want to have a critical person.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, I knew my decision would be taken without question. So it was a difficult decision, but I felt that we had to get these two climbers out. And I felt we should evacuate them over the ice, even knowing that we'd be risking other climbers. So we prepared to do that. The climbers organized themselves into rescue teams. I packed up the two climbers as best I could, keeping them as warm as I possibly could. And we started out with that in mind, going down the ice fall. We were at 21,000 feet, and we had a stretch to go of 2,000 feet, after which we would enter the ice fall, which is the most dangerous area filled with crevasses. And as we were going down the route, I was trailing behind the rescuers, and I remember thinking how I'm going to manage these climbers when I get them down to base camp, and you know what other problems I might encounter as we went through the ice fall. I didn't realize as we were going that the wind had died down, and all of a sudden I was startled to hear a noise, and then look up and see a helicopter. So the pilot had been monitoring the weather conditions. He noticed the lull in the wind immediately, and made a very daring rescue. He came in that lull in the wind and landed in a crevasse field and was able to lift out the two climbers. He was flying his helicopter above the limit that was considered safe for that helicopter. He was at 19,000 feet. The limit of the helicopter was 17,000 feet. But he risked his life to go higher and bring these climbers out. And, in fact, he did get them both out. He helicoptered them out to Kathmandu, where they were in a hospital before we even got back to base camp.
So in what conditions are Beck Weathers and McAlew now, the two people with the extreme frostbite who you treated?
Well, Beck I'm still very much in contact with. He's a pathologist. Lucky for him, it's about the only field of medicine you can practice without hands. Beck, in fact, unfortunately did lose both his hands. He has a prosthetic hand on one side, and he has a kind of a pinching mechanism on the other side. But he is able to function. He's gone back to work as a pathologist. And just like he didn't let the mountain stop him, he didn't let his disability stop him either. As for McAlew, he went to Alaska for treatment. He was in hospitals almost a year, but as he told me, he knew it was time to get back to Taiwan because the doctors in Alaska wanted to refashion a nose for him, and he said he didn't want to have a Caucasian nose, so he headed back to Taiwan, where I haven't heard from him since.
How did the deaths during the storm on Everest and the extreme injuries affect your attitude about climbing again?
Well, when you've climbed all over the world and had a lot of experiences, you always are involved with people who are dying on the mountain. It's not that unusual to have climbers die on the mountain. So it's something that we've all thought about, and we wouldn't be climbers if we didn't sort of accept that risk and understand that that can happen. But having said that, I have to say this was the first time that my friends died on the mountain, and that puts it in a whole other perspective. The risk is no longer abstract; it becomes real, and it's having a consolation like saying something like they died doing what they love. It suddenly seemed ridiculous. Nobody loves freezing to death, and saying things like we go for the thrill of the climb. It sounds pretty thin compared to the devastation you see in the families of the people who died up there. But the risk is inherent in climbing, and I think it's essential for the sport. It's part of the appeal, but it's not an appeal as a daredevil might enjoy it. Because in climbing, you assume a risk that makes you responsible for your actions, and your actions have direct, immediate consequences. It's a kind of a refreshing condition that's often lacking in modern lives, where the actions and the effects of what you do are dissipated. And someone like me who goes climbing has to just believe you can control a lot of the risk, keep it within an acceptable limit, although honestly I'm not sure that taking any risk is acceptable.
Well, Dr. Kamler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Kenneth Kamler speaking with Terry Gross. His memoir is Doctor on Everest, Emergency Medicine on the Top of the World. Coming up, a review of the newest P.D. James mystery. This is Fresh Air. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has left her guilty fingerprints all over P.D. James's new mystery novel, Death in Holy Orders. Here's her review.
P.D. James again? That's the enthusiastic response I got from a friend who asked what I planned on reviewing this week. It's true. Every time James issues another book, I review it. I guess I'm in a rut with P.D. James, who herself is in a rut, writing her Adam Dalgliesh mysteries year after year. This latest, Death in Holy Orders, is her 11th. But in our joint defense, allow me to get theoretical for a minute and suggest that ruttedness is precisely the great literary advantage that series fiction, in James's case detective series fiction, has over one-shot novels. As a writer of series fiction, James has had the luxury of developing her complex characters over decades. She's also rung slow, subtle changes on the familiar formula of the classic British mystery. For a loyal reader like me, part of the pleasure of reading James is the pleasure of being in the know, catching on to how Commander Adam Dalgliesh of Scotland Yard and the supporting cast of police characters has changed from book to book, noting the insider references to earlier cases. Death in Holy Orders serves up those same cerebral attractions as well as the restrained narrative suspense and palpable mood of dread that distinguishes James's best mysteries. But something else is also afoot here. James is now over 80, and I hope she's planning to write more mysteries, but I suspect Death in Holy Orders might well serve as the last of the Dalgliesh series. This story has an apocalyptic feel to it. Everything here is coming to an end. Even the stark East Anglian coastline where the book is set is crumbling into the sea. Also lending to the summing up tone of this story is the fact that James, brilliantly and sometimes comically, alludes here to the work of all the immortal mystery writers who've preceded her, starting with Edgar Allan Poe through Arthur Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, and the rest of that distinguished and murderous company. My final, and I think conclusive, piece of evidence for why Death in Holy Orders may be James's literary swan song is the fact that Adam Dalgliesh, James's solitary poet detective, falls in love by the end of this novel. Beyond bullets, knife wounds, or poison, the only thing that could kill off Dalgliesh's essentially gloomy character is happiness. The opening premise of Death in Holy Orders nods at the Gothic origins of mystery fiction. In a soon-to-be-closed theological college by the sea, the body of a young man studying for the Anglican priesthood has been found buried under a collapsed sandy outcropping. As one character puts it, the image of that boy gasping open-mouthed for air and finding only the killing sand haunts the atmosphere. Dalgliesh is called in because the boy's father, an influential business mogul, is dissatisfied with the inquest's verdict of accidental death. In rapid succession, three more corpses turn up, and soon Dogleash is creeping at night through the labyrinthine corridors of the college, desperately trying to outwit a criminal intelligence that, we're told, is equal to his own. If James weren't such an elegant and serious writer, the plot of Death in Holy Orders, which also references black masses and a secret Egyptian papyrus, could easily have devolved into slapstick. But James consistently has harbored loftier aims for her murder mysteries. Nowhere in her canon has James' almost religious appreciation for mystery with a capital M been more apparent than in this novel, which explicitly meditates on the problem of evil and on the future of faith in an increasingly godless world. Here's how one character cheekily dismisses organized religion. The church in the Middle Ages gave comfort and light and pictures and stories and the hope of everlasting life. The 21st century has other compensations, football for one. And then there's shopping, art and music, travel, alcohol, drugs. We all have our own resources for staving off those two horrors of human life, boredom and the knowledge that we die. And now, God help us, there's the internet. That character left out of his list of worldly compensations mystery novels, which in the case of P.D. James's own mystery novels have both entertained readers and prodded them to ponder the infinite. P.D. James again? I hope so. But something about the autumnal feel of Death in Holy Orders makes me think that it's a fitting and final eulogy for an extraordinary mystery series. But my hunch may be wrong. After all, I almost always pick the wrong suspect as the murderer.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Random House Incorporated's Delacourt Press Division, publisher of Far Appalachia, Following the New River North by Noah Adams, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mel Brooks. His movie The Producers has been adapted into a new Broadway musical. And we hear from Gary Sinise and Terry Kinney. They have a Broadway production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.